Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 21, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call on Zubik versus Burwell, more popularly known as the Little Sisters of the Poor case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back return guest Michael P. Moreland. He's a professor at Villanova Law School, but he's also now the Mary Ann Remick Senior Visiting Fellow and Concurrent Professor of Law at the University of Notre Dame. So he's joining us today on the line from Notre Dame University. He's going to give us some opening remarks, including background on the case, maybe 8 to 10 to 12 minutes or so, after which we'll be turning to you for questions from the audience. So please do be ready with those questions. With that, Professor Moreland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. It's nice to be with you this afternoon, talking about this case that will be argued on Wednesday, Zubik v. Burwell, as you say, better known as the Little Sisters of the Poor case. I'm sure some of the listeners are familiar with the background issues in the case, but I'll, for those who might not be or for whom it's been a while since they took constitutional law, I'll just say a few words by way of background on the legal and constitutional issues. So in Employment Division versus Smith back in 1990, the Supreme Court held in an opinion by Justice Scalia that as to neutral laws that are generally applicable, there is no right of free exercise exemption under the First Amendment from such neutral laws of general applicability. Congress responded to the decision in Employment Division versus Smith in 1993 by enacting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which was passed very easily in both houses, signed into law by President Clinton. And that statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, applies still to federal programs. It doesn't apply for reasons having to do with the enforcement power of Congress under the 14th Amendment. RFRA does not apply to the states and local governments, but it does apply to federal programs. And so that's the statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, under which the plaintiffs in Zubik versus Burwell are proceeding. Now, what are they objecting to? Well, in the Affordable Care Act, there's a requirement that employer-provided plans must include no cost-sharing, no copay required preventive services, and then leaves the statute leaves to the Department of Health and Human Services the determination of what counts as a preventive service. And so, the Department of Health and Human Services, after enactment of the ACA, asked the Institute of Medicine to take a look at what preventive services should be included under this requirement. And they came back and said that a range of contraceptives, including some contraceptive devices and drugs that have potential abortifacient properties, were required to be covered under the preventive services mandate. Now, when HHS put this requirement into regulation, though, it did exempt a set of religious employers, namely employers that are basically churches and their integrated auxiliaries. That's the term of art in the Internal Revenue Code. But they referred to this provision of the IRS code, the Internal Revenue Code, about churches and their integrated auxiliaries as the entities that will be exempt from the preventive services mandate, because, of course, HHS knew that there were some not small number of religious institutions that would object to having to include these services and drugs in their in the employer-provided plan. Now, what HHS did not exempt from the requirement were larger religious nonprofit institutions such as universities, hospitals, social service agencies, and the like. And they don't even have to be that large. I mean, just if they're not a house of worship or a church or its integrated auxiliary, they're not covered by the exemption that HHS initially put into the regulation. And of course, for-profit corporations were not included at all in the exemption. And so after some political controversy, some of you may remember, basically end of 2011, beginning of 2012, HHS, the administration came back and HHS put an accommodation into the requirement to cover preventive services and employer-provided plans by accommodating these nonprofit, mostly religious institutions by essentially, and we'll talk a little bit more about how the mechanics of this are part of the part of what's at issue in the case, but basically notifying the department that they object to providing these services. And then HHS will, once that objection is received, HHS is required then under the accommodation to work either with the employer's insurance company or with the third party administrator for entities that are self-insured, as some larger ones are, to provide for contraceptive coverage. Now, I mentioned for-profit companies were not, of course, given any exemption or accommodation at all. And that, of course, was the issue in the Hobby Lobby litigation, which culminated 2 years ago in the decision of the Supreme Court in Hobby Lobby versus Burwell, where applying the Religious Freedom Restoration Act's requirements, the court held that Hobby Lobby was entitled to an exemption. Now, what does RFRA require? RFRA requires that where there is a substantial burden on a religious claimant's free exercise, then the statute requires that then the government show that it has a compelling interest in imposing this burden and that the means it has chosen are the least restrictive. This is the familiar kind of strict scrutiny analysis from other contexts. And so the government has to show compelling interest in narrow tailoring. And that's what the court in Hobby Lobby, in an opinion from Justice Alito, held, that assuming for the sake of argument there's a compelling interest in requiring that these drugs and services be included, nonetheless, there's a less restrictive means of accomplishing the government's interest, less restrictive, that is, less burdensome on religious free exercise, namely the accommodation that was given to the nonprofits, which is noted in both the majority opinion and Justice Kennedy's concurrence as a way in which the government could provide for these drugs and services in a way that wouldn't implicate the employers. Well, so the next round of litigation involved these religious nonprofits who had the accommodation from the Department of Health and Human Services, but still had objections. They objected to having to provide notice of their objection, and they also made an argument, and this is really what the case will turn on. They made an argument that by notifying the department, what it then enables the government to do is, in their view, to commandeer their employer-provided health plan or their third-party administrator for the self-insured plans in order to provide the coverage to which they object. And so their argument is that they are still implicated in providing drugs and devices and services to which they have a sincerely held religious objection. And that's really the crux of the issue now in the Little Sisters case, is whether or not that that the mechanism of that accommodation constitutes a substantial burden on the free exercise and religious beliefs and conduct of the plaintiffs. The government has this refrain in its briefs and in its arguments that the plaintiffs in these cases are objecting to having to object, that they're, that the mere fact of having to object is what they are asserting is a substantial burden on their religious free exercise. And the government says that's a bridge too far, that in the free exercise case law, both before Smith and since Smith under RFRA, that such a slight burden or really no burden at all in the government's view of noting your objection to the government can't constitute a substantial burden on free exercise. And furthermore, the government argues the means chosen here are the least restrictive, that there is really no other workable alternative way in order for the government to get these drugs and services included in people's health plans. The plaintiffs, as I say, their argument against that is that it's not merely objecting to having to object, but it's instead giving a permission slip, as it were, to the government to commandeer the health plans or the third-party administrators to provide the service to which they object, and that there are less restrictive means of accomplishing the government's objective, again, assuming the compelling interest prong is met, namely the government, either through Title X family planning funding or through the healthcare plans that the government itself sponsors on the healthcare exchanges, could provide for these services and drugs in a way that wouldn't implicate the employers in having to provide them. And so that's what this case will turn on, is whether or not the plaintiffs are successful in their argument that this is, in fact, a substantial burden, that it does trigger the RFRA analysis that we've talked about already, and furthermore, that there's no that there are less restrictive means of accomplishing those interests and getting the drugs and services to the covered employees without having to implicate them in the provision of it. There are a lot of other issues, of course, I've skipped over. I'm happy to talk about precedents that will be in play in this case. Happy to talk more about Hobby Lobby, talk more about Employment Division versus Smith. Any of those issues are fair play, but I think I've given a little bit of a background here, and I'm happy to start entertaining questions.
Okay. Thank you so much, Professor Moreland. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Michael Moreland, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. Let me start, Professor, if I could, by asking you a question we unfortunately have to ask again and again, it seems. What effect, in your mind, will the absence of Justice Scalia on the bench, maybe during argument and obviously for the ultimate outcome of the case, what will his absence mean, if you can speak to that a little bit?
Right. Well, sadly, we do have to discuss that. So, if of course, the key question is, assuming that the four dissenters in Hobby Lobby will say that this the religious nonprofits accommodation does not deserve the relief under RFRA, that their objections shouldn't be recognized under RFRA. So that's four votes for the government. And then the question is whether or not, there are still four votes for the plaintiffs. And that turns partly on whether or not Justice Kennedy, who concurred in Hobby Lobby, noting the alternative means of delivering these contraceptive drugs and services that was available, that meant that the RFRA's scrutiny was basically met for the plaintiffs in Hobby Lobby, whether or not he agrees, continues to take that position with regard to the Little Sisters and the plaintiffs in these cases. If so, then we have a 4-4 deadlock. And as people are learning in other cases in which there could be a 4-4 deadlock on the court, that means either that the court could put the case over for rehearing once the court has a ninth justice to break the tie, or it could just affirm by an equally divided court the lower court rulings. The tricky thing there is that the circuits are split. The Eighth Circuit agreed with the plaintiffs in these cases that they should be get relief under RFRA. All the other circuits took the government's position. So what you'd end up with is basically the plaintiffs in the Eighth Circuit's jurisdiction being able to successfully object under RFRA to this. And in the other circuits, the government's position would prevail and the plaintiffs would have to comply with the contraceptive mandate requirements.
All right. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got lots of callers, but just one question at this point, so our lines will be open after that. Push the star button, then the pound button if you'd like to ask a question. Let's go to our first caller now.
Hi, this is Will Trackman from Littler Mendelsohn out in Denver. I believe there was a stay issued in the case, and part of the stay involved organizations like the Little Sisters having to submit a letter or some kind of form other than the EBSA 700 that's at issue in the case. At that level where they have to, somehow the government has to obtain the information that this organization won't provide birth control, right? So whatever that method is, is Little Sisters saying that there's no method of conveying information that would be compliant with RFRA?
Well, I don't know if they're taking that position. I think their position, of course, is that the exemption that was given to churches and integrated auxiliaries should also be accorded to other religious institutions, and that the government should find another way to provide the services on the exchanges, as I said, or some other way. But you're right that there were some flurries of litigation earlier on in these cases involving whether the form basically that the plaintiffs had to file in order to lodge their objections. And in the Little Sisters case coming out of the 10th Circuit and in others, a case involving Wheaton College was another one coming out of the 7th Circuit, the court stayed enforcement of the contraceptive mandate and also the government's requirement that a particular form be the means by which the plaintiffs would lodge their objections, and said that they could do it by any means they chose. And I should say, how much of that will affect the ultimate resolution of the case? It's a little hard to say. Again, even though Justice Sotomayor, for example, was the one who issued the stay in the Tenth Circuit case involving the Little Sisters and the form that they had to file, I think it's anyone's guess whether or not she would, given that she was a dissenter. In Hobby Lobby, also dissented from the stay in the Wheaton College case, that she would be anything but a vote for the government in this case.
You mentioned, this is Dean, you mentioned the exemptions, which I take it are statutory, but then you mentioned accommodations, which I think originally were by executive action. Have those accommodations, were they ever formalized through a regulatory process?
They were, and I should say the exemptions were also, those were through the regulatory process as well. It was when HHS promulgated the rule that these contraceptive services had to be included in employer-provided plans, they wrote into that regulation the religious exemption, which I should, just as a footnote, by the way, that was one thing that Justice Kennedy at oral argument in Hobby Lobby noted as a particular concern of his, which is still applicable in this case, namely that it's an administrative agency that's making decisions about what religious institution should be exempt and what should not. And in his view, that that was problematic because it wasn't as politically accountable, politically accountable, as if it were done by statute. But then you're right. So then after the flurry of controversy in early 2012 over the refusal of extending the exemption on the part of the government to other religious nonprofits, the president announced this, basically this accommodation, and then that was what was then put into rule about a year or so later by HHS.
Just one quick follow-up question, then we'll take another question from the audience. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have one question pending, but before we move on to that, you mentioned Justice Kennedy's concern about the administrative agency being the one deciding who gets an accommodation or an exemption. Was that detail specifically delegated to the agency, or would that maybe be a concern of the Chief Justice as well, who under an earlier Affordable Care Act case decided that the question at issue was so significant that had Congress intended to delegate decision-making authority to the IRS on that issue, they would have done so explicitly?
Right. Well, the fact is the statute just doesn't speak to this at all, right? It just lays out a general requirement for preventive services to be covered without copay and employer-provided plans. Doesn't get at all into what those preventive services might look like. I mean, there's some general idea it involves, you know, physicals and things like that. But then certainly doesn't say anything about religious exemptions from the preventive services requirement. And so I do think that that, as you say, there's a background concern here about an administrative agency deciding what kinds of religious institutions will be covered or which will not, and which will get an exemption and which will not, that I think should give some pause to some members of the court.
We got a couple more questions pending now, so let's go to our next call.
Hi, Michael. It's Bill Saunders. I wanted to ask you a follow-up on a couple of previous points. The possibility of a 4-4 deadlock, and then the court could hold it over for rehearing, or affirm the decisions, which would result in split circuits.
Right.
I mean, among a lot of us, you know, we think that one of the main reasons the court takes these cases is to resolve conflicts between the circuits. Would it be highly unusual for, I mean, maybe this whole situation is so unusual, but can you think of other circumstances in which the court has affirmed where you have divided circuits on something, you know, First Amendment type well, it's statutory, but anyway, religious freedom rights?
Offhand, I mean, of course, it's an unusual situation where the court would have an even, or at least historically recent, court would have an even number of justices and then fail to resolve ties one way or the other when you have a circuit split. So I can't think of any. I mean, I every once in a while I've heard people say that there are some issues which have never been resolved by the Supreme Court on which the circuits are divided. But on a case of this kind of profile, it would be very unusual indeed. Now, as I said, there's only one circuit, the Eighth, in which the plaintiffs won below. And so to that extent, it's not as if it's 50-50 or something like that. But it would leave that circuit split in place. And it would, as I said, mean that the plaintiffs in the Eighth Circuit would not have to comply with the mandate. And presumably the government would then have to, I guess, find if it wanted to deliver these, get these services delivered, would have to come up with some mechanism for doing so for those covered in the states of the Eighth Circuit, and then everywhere else the plaintiffs would be out of luck and would have to comply with the requirement, at least insofar as they would have to lodge their objections such that the government could then administer through their administrator or insurance plan the contraceptive mandate.
Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Just a quick note from me, Mike Moreland. I had some people do some research here and know that as recently as 2010, when Justice Kagan came on the court, she recused herself in 28 out of 75 mm-hmm. cases her first term. So over a third of those cases right. were decided 4-4. I have no idea right. about the substance of those cases and whether any of them right. were as related to religious liberties or to RFRA, indeed. But once again, push the star button and the pound button. Did you want to respond to that, Mike?
Well, the recent setting aside Hobby Lobby, the recent RFRA or Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which is a later RFRA-type statute for a particular context, those cases have all been almost unanimous. In fact, they might have all been unanimous. The Huasca T case, Gonzalez versus Ocentro, the prison beard case from last term, those were all resolved pretty clearly. So there were no splits that had to be resolved on those cases.
And would you characterize those as having tended to be resolved in favor of expansive religious liberties or?
Certainly, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Once again, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. We've got just one question pending, but let's take this next question.
Hello. I have a question regarding a possible argument by the government. I noticed that Kennedy, in his concurrence in Hobby Lobby, mentioned the importance of the accommodation not affecting the rights of the women who would want a contraception that right. that would work. And I noticed, I think it was the prison beard case, Ginsburg reiterated that point and made much of it as if to sort of strengthen it as if it's a requirement of RFRA. And then the argument by the government focused a lot on this notion of seamless coverage that, if they had a supplement plan by the government, it wouldn't be sufficient because, this must be seamless. Do you see that playing much role? Because I noticed that it's really an Establishment Clause argument, not a RFRA-free exercise argument.
Right. It's an argument that some scholars have developed recently, arguing that the Establishment Clause prohibits the granting of exemptions that would have substantial third-party harms, basically, and that in these cases, because there's a third-party harm, namely the affected employees who don't get their coverage, or as you say, don't get it seamlessly from their employer-provided plan, but have to get another plan to cover it, that somehow this would be a third-party harm. I will say that, I mean, there both Justice Alito's opinion in Hobby Lobby and in other scholarly responses to this, I think there's an argument that this third-party harm argument is not quite as strong as at least some on the other side have made it out to be. After all, lots of religious freedom claims would have third-party harms, but that doesn't mean that just by force of that the government should always prevail. But you're right to seize on what Justice Kennedy says in his concurrence in Hobby Lobby, because, as I say, that will be, I think, one of the key issues on which his vote will turn, namely whether or not the ability of the government to provide these drugs and services in some other way will mean that there is no real harm or no really significant harm to the covered employees, or whether having to provide the coverage, as you say, in some kind of seamless way is of sufficient importance that the government will prevail. I mean, the scholars who are making these arguments, people like colleagues and friends of mine like Nelson Tebbe and Micah Schwartzman, point to earlier cases such as Calder and some cases from the Burger Court era, in which there's something to this idea that that exemptions run up against Establishment Clause concerns. But again, it hasn't, I don't think it, at least in terms of being recognized outside of some very particular precincts, has yet taken hold.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone if you have a question. We've got one more question pending. Let's take another call. Caller, your microphone's been activated. You might have yourself on mute.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Yes, I'm curious if there was, let's say you did have the split decision of 4-4 and the court did just kick it back to the circuits, would plaintiffs then have a subsequent standing to come back later, or would they be prevented due to the split?
Well, that's a good Fed Courts question, isn't it? I mean, they could relitigate. I mean, if it's a 4-4 decision of the Supreme Court is not a decision on the merits, right? And so they could still seek cert to get the merits adjudicated by the Supreme Court once the court had a ninth justice to break the tie. But in the meantime, until the court would be willing to grant cert on such a petition, they would, as I say, in the circuits other than the eighth, they would have to comply with the accommodation as it is.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask you, I've got two questions about the tests under RFRA, the substantial burden question. Substantial burden, how is that argued in a case in the lower courts and even at the Supreme Court level? Is it always, is it a subjective test? Is it an objective test? What sort of proof does a plaintiff have to offer to talk about whether it's a substantial burden on their, on them?
Well, it's a good question. And as I say, it's one of the central issues in the case, because the government is arguing that courts should not be, as they have often been, highly deferential toward religious free exercise plaintiffs in what does or does not constitute a substantial burden. I mean, usually there would be, sometimes you get these, kind of wild off the margin cases, but for the most part, there are cases in which a plaintiff in sincerity would come into litigation and say, here's the burden, and it's a centrally held belief or an important belief for my religion. And there really wasn't much scrutiny of that. And again, mostly because there's no doubt about the sincerity of it. And there was more or less a kind of subjective deference to the plaintiff in those cases. And this is a case in which the government is trying to upend that a little bit, right? The government's saying that, look, this is just, in the government's view, again, this is just objecting to having to object. It's like someone who wants a draft exemption refusing even to notify the draft board of their conscientious objection to being drafted into the military. And that the courts have never recognized or have never been that deferential to a religious free exercise plaintiff when it's so clearly, in the government's view, a de minimis obligation on the part of the plaintiff. So that will be a key issue in the case. There's no doubt that the government, the government's litigation strategy in Hobby Lobby turned largely on disputing whether or not for-profit corporations could be covered under RFRA at all, and arguably the government didn't spend as much time developing its position on the strict scrutiny analysis of RFRA. Here in this case, the government is putting a lot of emphasis on the substantial burden argument, saying that this isn't really a burden on religious free exercise. But they're also, of course, making arguments about compelling interest and narrow tailoring under the RFRA analysis. So we'll see. But you're right to call attention to it. I think it, at least at oral argument, and I suspect in whatever opinion we get out of this case, it will be an important one on just that issue.
We do have another question from our audience, so let's now take another call.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. Because the Affordable Care Act is, at least in theory, a statute that Congress has passed, and because each branch of the federal government is actually responsible for acting constitutionally and upholding the Constitution in the laws that it passes, would it, in your opinion, be possible for Congress to hold congressional hearings on this very issue to find that in the case of the Little Sisters of the Poor, based on congressional hearings, that this is indeed a substantial burden on genuinely held religious beliefs, and then pass special legislation exempting the Little Sisters of the Poor from this requirement? In other words, is there a legislative solution that starts returning the powers of the government to the people through their elected legislatures where they belong, instead of continuing down this primrose path of the court making the law and then finding that the law that it's made must require this solution?
Sure, Congress could do that, and there was a failed attempt to do something like that when the HHS mandate was first being promulgated and debated. The problem is that it ran up against a Democratic filibuster in the Senate. But I mean, they can hold hearings on almost anything they want, and you're right that if filibuster were successfully overcome in the Senate, or however it would happen legislatively, Congress could amend this by statute. Of course, Congress could also, in the Affordable Care Act, could have said that RFRA doesn't apply to the preventive services mandate. They didn't do that. RFRA can always be tweaked or held not applicable in particular contexts, but you could also, as you say, have a legislative fix on behalf of the plaintiffs in these cases, but that hasn't succeeded so far.
Thank you.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, our lines are open. We still have some time available. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We do have another question, so let's carry on.
Michael, it's Bill again. I just wanted to ask you the mechanism for holding over. How does that work? I mean, if they have a kind of vote in chambers that's a 4-4, does the Chief Justice make that call, or is that a mystery we don't know, or do, you know, because that's, you know, some of them might want to affirm the lower courts, and some might want to hold over.
Right, and so I think it would depend, of course, either the court could just issue an order saying that that the lower court decisions, divided as they are affirmed by an equally divided court, or if it takes a while for the opinion to come out or for the decision to come out, this is probably what's happening. Or even if they are divided 4-4, they could be the four on each side might want to write on it, right? Might want to issue an opinion arguing on one side or the other. So you could either have just, and again, I think that would be up to the justices, right? Whether or not to just issue a per curiam order, which could come down very quickly after the case is heard, as soon as the, right after the conference in which they tally up their votes, or they could take the opportunity to write on both sides of the case, in which event it would take a little longer for it to come out. But you'd have the same result either way, right? You'd have an affirmance of the circuit court positions. And of course, there are other cases, given the sad news of Justice Scalia's passing, there are other cases in which this likely could happen, such as the Texas abortion case on which the court heard oral argument on March 2nd. You could have the same kind of result.
But I guess what I was wondering is, if you have this vote in chambers and they're split 4-4, I mean, what if, you know, half the justices want to issue a per curiam or something, and the other four want to hold it over?
Oh.
Is that, does the Chief Justice make that call, or do we know?
Well, you need, that's a good question. Someone who's more familiar with the inner workings of the Supreme Court would be better positioned to answer it. If you need a majority to do anything, right? balance being tipped one way or the other in order for the court to do anything in that context. And I suspect, as it would work out, is you're right, the Chief Justice would take it upon himself to find a way to sort of muddle through this and figure out how procedurally to get the decision out.
Let me make another final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Professor, I don't see that final question. Let me revert to you and give you a chance to wrap up, if you'd like.
Well, thanks again to you, Dean, to Federal Society for putting this teleconference on. There are some hard questions there. I may not have answered some of the, especially sort of federal courts procedural questions as adequately as I might have. But I do think this is an interesting case. It's an interesting moment in the debate about religious freedom in our country. I think whatever result we get out of it, I think it will galvanize people on both sides of these issues. I do think it will probably also get some play in the presidential campaign, given the divisions in the country on this. So it's, I think, given the issues, it's one of the most important cases of the term. It may end up, as Bill and I were talking about, it may end up in a 4-4 split, which itself would be something. But we'll just wait and see. And the oral argument is on Wednesday, and we'll get the decision. As I said, we could get a decision very quickly if the court's evenly divided and merely wants to affirm the lower courts. But more likely, I suspect, we'll get some opinions in June.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. To our audience, thank you as well for joining in. Let me make an announcement about a couple upcoming calls. Tomorrow, at a time yet to be determined, we'll be talking about the RJR Nabisco versus European Community case. That's whether or not RICO applies extraterritorially. That is going to be tomorrow at a time to be determined. Then on Wednesday, as Professor Moreland mentioned, this case, Little Sister's case, Zubik, is going to be argued. We will have a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum on Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. So please check the website, check your emails for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. There are others to be had. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.